And we'll gather our best minds next time. We really have a challenge then.
Then I'll prepare something special. Perhaps I'll make you disappear.
Greetings and well met, travelers. You have found your way to Dragonreel, a magical journey to the realm of fantasy movies.
Welcome back to the Dragonreel podcast. I am Chris, and I return to you to demonstrate how nature's laws can be bent. And perhaps I will make her disappear. It's Sharon.
I am not following you to Budapest.
No, Utapest, and that's the problem.
Introduce the next person.
That joke is the problem. That's what it comes down to.
The joke is very much the problem. But how close can we be to such as him? It's Pete.
It depends. Do you want to be the chief of police or possibly the mayor of Vienna?
I want to be me, man.
Okay.
In chair number four, Matt, are you completely corrupt?
Yes.
Good for you.
Then our work here is done.
Mostly corrupt.
All right. Welcome back to Dragonreel. And I want to remind our listeners that we have a drawing going on March 21st for a $25 Barnes & Noble gift card. And that will be if you go to iTunes and leave us a review. And then email us at dragonreelpodcast@gmail.com and tell us which review is yours. And, well, we already know some of the reviews have already been claimed. The first person to claim a particular review is going to be entered into the drawing. And we'll be drawing on March 21st, and you can win and help us out, help us help you make the show better.
Excellent.
Now, on with the show. Speaking of The Illusionist, this came out in 2006.
My pick.
Sharon's pick. And it was chosen because it was chosen in contrast to The Prestige, which also came out in 2006.
My pick.
Which was Matt's pick. So they were both kind of fantasy. They were both about stage magic. And when they came out, I didn't see either one of them. And so in my mind, they were kind of conflated into a very similar thing. But after watching them both back to back, they're not similar at all.
Yes, one is good and the other one is The Illusionist.
What? Oh my goodness! I love this movie.
Doesn't
so sure. I say I love that, but it definitely. I even though it wasn't in the same league as The Prestige, I don't think it's a terrible film either.
I quite like it as well, while recognizing its flaws.
I think the part that's similar is that you learn a lot about the magic profession. That's how they're similar. Is that two movies came out at the same time? And they were talking to you about the craft of magic.
Right. And I think that's where the similarity ends.
Okay. I might agree there.
The Illusionist is very much a love story.
That's
and
why I
The
like
Prestige
it.
Is very much a hate story.
Yeah. That is, that's very deep, Chris.
I know, right?
It's very well put also. Very well put.
But I think that's why you like The Illusionist more. It is a love story.
And I think our listening audience knows that I've stated it many times that I like
sure.
love stories.
And I don't think, although there were people who claimed to love one another in The Prestige, I don't think there was really any romance. I mean, there was that little, you know, walk the girl home and then they're dating and then they're married and then she's got a baby coming. But I don't really think that qualifies.
No, it was more of an obsession, which is a form of love, but it was not towards other humans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's toward magic.
Yeah.
In the prestige,
yeah. Yeah. And again, we skirt that kind of line where this has one toe in fantasy, and Eisenheim does seem to have magic powers, even though, like, if we take ourselves back from, you know, from what we saw on stage and or what we saw on screen, and just imagine that that is how it would have been seen by people of that age, then you could say that there's no actual magic in this at all, just stagecraft.
Yeah, I would say it has less of a fantasy conceit than even The Prestige, because The Prestige at least dabbled in the unbelievable, and this one didn't, and I'm sorry to have interrupted.
I would agree with you, Matt, that I think that The Prestige, we chose it because it did have that part in fantasy, and it could be said that The Illusionist isn't exactly fantasy. But I still love this movie anyway.
Right.
And it just depends if you're walking the road that says Eisenheim, did I say it right? Eisenheim?
Yeah, yeah.
Did have magical powers, because like you said, if you were a person in the audience in the 1800s, and if you believed he did, you could walk that way, or you could just think, oh, it's all, what's the expression? Mirrors and smoke? Smoke and mirrors.
S&M.
Yeah. And when we saw the making of the movie, they explained that they used tricks that were done at that time period.
Real quick, just wanted to, we should probably sum up what the movie was about to the audience. That is,
you want to do it, or you want me to do it?
Oh, I'll do it real quick. Well, I'm not going to do a nice version of it, so maybe you should do it.
I will do the nice version, which is what I see on IMDb. In the turn of the century Vienna, a magician uses his abilities to secure the love of a woman far above his social standing. Now, how would you put it, Matt?
Stage magician fights a evil prince to win woman. Stuff happens. Very boring.
Oh, my God.
I would say, as if we're going to, because the elephant in the room is the prestige, so thank God that we have already acknowledged it, because a Wikipedia tells me a third movie about magic came out the same year, so that's kind of interesting. But like, this movie is the Solange to the prestige's Beyonce. Like, it's this movie that it would be totally forgettable, and we wouldn't even remember it. We would not remember this if it were not for a better movie that came out, and we conflate them, because I conflated them too. Like, I remember the scene with the, your hand's whiter because you held it up. Like, that scene was always in the prestige for me, but didn't actually occur in the prestige.
No,
but, you know, so just, like, I took the one of the good moments from this movie and inserted it into the prestige, like, you know, but this movie just is pale shadow of, sorry. Anyways, yes, and I have a list.
Completely disagree with him. Yes. There are scenes in this that I completely adore, like the scene. I mean, there are so many. The scenes between Eisenheim and Inspector Uhl.
Oh yes, those are some good scenes. Those are some okay scenes.
Oh, okay.
Paul Giamatti is very good in those.
Oh, I love him when the main characters are kids in the beginning. I started tearing up when they were like ripped apart from each other. Oh, that really like tore my heart apart. And then when she, you know, has the locket still on her and you realize that they love each other. Oh.
The beginning part for me was kind of oversimplified, but I believe that was on purpose. I mean, that wasn't a really good love story for them, for her to just see him balancing an egg. And then like their entire love stems from that. And the fact that he could do card tricks for her, and then they're in love. There's no real progression of the relationship to me. But also, this is Inspector Uhl telling the story, and this is all hearsay.
All right, sorry. So I think that the opening was actually some of the worst writing / beginning to anything. It's in they literally told you, like, did not show you them falling in love. They were like, and then they fell in love. And then they, you know, and it was just background. It was literally just background. There was no experience of it as a character or as an audience member. It was, other than them being ripped apart because they fell in love for some reason we still don't understand. It was literally narrated to us. This breaks rule number one of show, don't tell. So that infuriated me. The bad effects at the beginning was also, it was like the effects were so bad. It was like they were lampshading them. And so like the first 5 minutes, you're like, you lost me. The end.
When you say the first 5 minutes, do you mean when he's being arrested, or do you mean in the flashback where where he's a kid?
Okay. And I hate frame devices. Like they did this, even though they did it in the prestige.
Yeah.
They did it well in this one. They framed and then like, oh, there's going to be this moment. Like, yeah, okay, that's somewhat interesting. And then like the flashback was just the heavy handedest, just, oh, clumsy. It was so clumsy.
What are your thoughts?
To me? Sorry. Yeah. Well, I think that for the most part, that it is very fast at the beginning. I think that Neil Berger, being a first-time director, rushed it because he felt that the meat of the story was the conflict with the prince. I also think that the story, I think that for the most part to the director, the real grist for the film was Eisenheim versus Prince Leopold.
Okay.
I don't think it was necessarily the love story. I think the love story just fueled the conflict. But I also feel like the fact that he starts out with the fact that he's the son of a word worker and he comes across a traveling magician, and then depending on who tells the story, the magician disappears and so does the tree. You know, things like that. I think that's kind of the tongue-in-cheek, clever way that Uhl is, shorthanding an otherwise potentially longer story. I also like the fact that that kind of starts Eisenheim's lifelong love of magic, and I love the fact that it shows him practicing tricks in his room. I think that's a lot of fun.
That Aaron Johnson learned that trick to do on camera, so...
I liked that part, too.
I really felt like the opening part that it had told on show on was because it was a freshman director trying to get to the heart of what he felt was the important bit of the story.
Okay.
See, now I didn't mind it at all. I think they showed it was maybe between 5 and 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It was short, but you get the point.
No,
so,
I agree with you. I thought it was handled very briefly and very cursorily. And initially it bothered me, but when I realized this is Uhl telling the story and this is information that he gathered, I was kind of okay with it. I don't mind. And it really isn't the important part of the story. The important part of the story is what they're doing, not how they met and fell in love. You know, it could have been much better presented. It could have been better developed.
Let's compare and contrast to The Prestige, you know, like, oh, they end up hating each other. We actually see them being friendly like this one. We can actually see them, you know, getting along. And we see all those moments of, you know, them falling into hate for each other. So, yeah, but that's a show, don't tell. And this one was a literally tell. And I think that they were lampshading everything, which is the term of if you're going to do something bad, like point out that it's bad. And I think that's why the effects were so poor.
So I think the effects were, I don't know if the effects were bad or if it was presented on old timey film for the, to put you in the time period.
And I think that's exactly what lampshading would be. Like, if you're like, well, it's supposed to be bad because it's like saying like, oh, the album's supposed to be difficult. You're not supposed to like it. You're, you know, like it's a cheap way out for saying you made bad music.
That was a part that I couldn't see. But when you watch the producer's cut, he says... The director's commentary, yeah. He says that was intentional. But just to contrast from you guys, I loved it. I think I like stories where they show things that happened when you were kids. And they showed a couple quick scenes with them. And it just that part didn't bother me at all. But I'm curious to know what some of the other parts were, Matt, that you didn't care for, or maybe even some scenes that you did like contrast some of the things that you did and didn't like about this movie.
I think that all the characters, with the exception of Paul Giamatti, I'm not looking at his name right now. Uhl, other than Uhl, they were just flat, all of them. I mean, she was there to like, oh, I love you. Let's run away together. I'm dead. You know, Rufus Sewell, who I adore, his whole point was just to be a bad guy. And, you know, he did a great bad guy. And Edward Norton, who I love as an actor, just was there. Like I can't say anything good about his performance. And we know he's a good actor.
And I love you, Matt, but I'm completely on the opposite spectrum. I loved it. I completely believed him. I really thought that he was a performer. And I love so many of the lines from this. I just completely believe when he's talking to the prince and he says, you know, maybe I'll make you disappear. And I just...
Oh, he was talking to Sophie at that point. So that brings me to my next question. So I would like to have Sharon tell us how this movie is presented for a blind person's enjoyment, because Sharon is blind, and I think we need to detail how these movies are received when someone is deprived of one sense.
I love this movie, but it's not the best movie mm-hmm. for blind folks, because especially the end, there's a montage of visual things
right.
that go back and kind of give you a different perspective, a different way of looking at everything. But it's mostly done through pictures. And I mean, a lot of movies do that. So I'm not criticizing this movie because of that, but there was no last audible line.
Right. There's no stinger. There's no punchline, really.
You see them together. You realize she's not dead, but only if you have somebody, like I had somebody sighted explaining to me what was being shown on the screen. So even though this is one of my personal favorites, it's just, but I could also say the same thing about The Prestige. There were a lot of scenes that you could only understand it if somebody was explaining to you the visual part.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not pick these two movies as a top choice for blind folks,
mm-hmm.
unless you had somebody describing the action. Right. And neither one of these movies have.
Right. We did not have audio description on the desk.
Wait a minute. There wasn't for The Illusionist, but was there for The Prestige? I don't believe there was.
You said there wasn't at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. So, yeah.
Sharon has a hard time distinguishing in her memory whether there was professional audio description or just my audio description.
Oh, yeah. Because Chris
it's just that.
Chris is really good at describing things. And you described some of the scenes, like with the butterflies and the orange tree and some of the mm-hmm. the tricks in this, but just listening to Edward Norton, I completely believed that he was who he said he was. And some of my favorite scenes were between him and Inspector Uhl, but also I liked the scene where the prince got really angry at Sophie because, mm-hmm.
Because she was drugging him.
Well, she kind of pushed him to the limit, and he showed us his angry side. But, I mean, he slapped her, and that's never acceptable. So even though she it was framed and she kind of pushed him, as you find out later, he was an evil bad guy. And so I don't feel sorry for him at all that,
I think that's interesting, kind of the point of it. It's interesting that, to me, one of the things I hated was that it was told, not shown. Like, even, like, the prince is a bad guy. We don't see him slapping her around until that point. Or even though, like, I've heard that he threw a woman out of the, just because he had killed her, like, to hide the bruises. And you're like, oh, that's terrible. Thank you, exposition bot. I'm glad you gave me this information.
That was important to have told us, but I don't think it would have been... I can't think of an appropriate way for them to have shown us that he killed a previous girlfriend. I think having that as a whispered rumor in the movie is, yeah, I think that's enough to let us know that there's no redeeming qualities, that it's okay at the end that he dies.
Yeah, but I mean, Rufus Sewell, you can trust him to be a bad guy. He can pull off bad guy without having to force feed us the information. But which is interesting that is things that you enjoyed about it, not being able to actually see the things. Like, just look at Rufus Sewell's face, and you're like, oh, I hate that man. Yeah, there's no redeeming qualities there.
Yeah.
Well, he's, can you play some of that, please?
Which part?
Just any of, I love Rufus. How do you say his name?
So this is Rufus Sewell.
Yeah.
I know you like him because he's in Dangerous Beauty.
I love him for a lot of things. He was also, I think, in The Holiday. But he was
Dark City, anyone?
Oh, yes, right. Dark City.
And the jousting movie, right, with the Joker?
I was going to say, was he in
Night's Tale?
Yeah, Night's Tale. So there's this, and I think this is like, he really thinks he's, you know, he not only thinks he's the smartest person in the room, he thinks he's morally entitled to be the best person and to be looked up to, because he says stuff like this.
He tries to trick you. I try to enlighten you. Which is the more noble pursuit?
See, you, I mean, he's just such an ass. And I mean, he really is. Everything he says in this, and you know, that's another thing I actually like about this movie, is you can be a know-it-all and be like a likable know-it-all, but he's an absolute jerk.
Well, he is the villain of the film.
I mean, I know that.
They set it up early on that he's the person you're not supposed to like. And while Paul Giamatti is a villain to our hero, he's a villain you can sympathize with. He's a villain who is doing his job. He doesn't hate Eisenheim.
He's an antagonist. He's not a villain.
Right.
He's like force of nature. Like he's the mountain that's in the way. He's, you know, not personally upset at you, but yeah, he's there to stop you.
I love the scene between the two of them in the restaurant. Do we have anything from the?
Oh, we do.
Sharon normally
asks me first what my favorite scene is. So I'm just going to tell you, it was this one where they're in the cafe and it's the first time Eisenheim is brought to Inspector Uhl, and he's just sitting there enjoying his lunch. He's like, sit. You know, and he says this.
Eisenheim, I'm going to ask you a question that may not seem friendly, but I assure you, in fact, is.
And that scene between the two of them, I just find, okay, so, confession time. We were watching the commentary, and I swear to God, I was reaching for the remote to pause it, to tell Sharon, this reminds me a lot of the scene between Pacino and De Niro in the cafe in Heat, in the movie Heat. Because the whole point of that scene is for the people who are opposing each other to say, look, I'm going to do what I got to do. And the other person to say, well, I got to do what I got to do.
And this is really true. When we were watching it, I can say that's what happened, that Chris was so mad.
I was gonna say this, and then the director said it on the commentary before I could pause the movie.
Because this is a podcast, you couldn't see me take off my glasses and rub my eye, comparing that scene to Heat in one of the most amazing, iconic scenes ever. Like, yeah, I can see why you'd make that comparison, but no, qualitatively, no.
Well, that's okay. And that's why we're doing this podcast, because we have different, you know, and it's all good. It's all good. And Pete, did you want to add something to that?
Are we doing favorite scenes? Or?
Yeah. Pete, what's your favorite scene?
My favorite scene is when they are going through Eisenheim's workshop and Uhl sees the Orange Tree notebook and he can't help but look. And that's where, knowing that that was the temptation, that's where Eisenheim left a clue.
Right. That was the setup. So that's kind of like the diaries in The Prestige. Sharon, what was your favorite scene?
Didn't you guess?
No.
When she rides to the cabin and they start to argue a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But you know, like, I just thought there was a lot of chemistry between them. And then I think he kisses her there, and then he takes her in to his house, and they have some fun intimately.
And then that's a little sheet music.
I also loved the music. In this
okay,
too.
We'll talk about that later. But
wait,
we got to get Matt's favorite scene before we go on to the music.
I have to say the scene where he pisses off the Crown Prince Leopold with the sword and gets it stuck in the ground. It was so on the nose. It was so metaphoric, but damn it, it was good. It was well done, and
it
you
was.
Can see just like the just needling him. That was a very good scene.
No surprise there.
Perhaps you, sir.
Not so eager, cousin.
Great line.
Yeah.
Not so eager, cousin. And then he asks him, he tells him, oh, that painting was easy to, that trick was easy. You
right.
simply had a sprayer up your
But the thing is, the things the prince is saying, these things are all true for how the tricks were performed at that time. And most of the tricks that he does, in fact, I think all of the tricks that he does, are based on tricks that existed in that time. So I think we've all covered all our favorite scenes. Pete, what do you have to say?
I just wanted to throw in, I like the fact that after the cousin wasn't able to move the sword, he looked at Leopold and said, you'll live a very long life.
Yes.
A little bit of foreshadowing there.
So Sharon brought up the soundtrack on our previous segment. What did you want to say about the soundtrack, Sharon?
I just for me, it heightened the love story.
Uh-huh.
And it was sort of, to me, it was sort of mysterious, but it had like a sort of minor, something's a little bit off here.
Mm.
And it just kind of made it feel that, what's going on here type of feeling.
So Matt, what did you think about the soundtrack?
I remember thinking it sounded very, I don't want to say dated, it sounded classical. And I see that it was composed by Philip Glass, so that would make sense. And so they definitely went with the big name on that one. But unless they're going with something that just like Inception with the sound, like the sound doesn't really register for me.
What about Pete?
I enjoyed it. I thought it played into the parts very nicely. I really enjoyed the I like the way that they shot, and I like the way that they put the soundtrack over the sex scene.
Yeah, I especially like that too.
I like the soundtrack for this movie. However, I don't think I could listen to it by itself because most of the time it's just doing a doodly dingly doodly dingly doodly dingly doodly dingly doodly dingly, and that just and there's like maybe a minor chord being played out. For the most part, it just sounds like a doodly dingly a lot.
I liked the different themes. I liked the Locket theme, and it doesn't sound like that to me at all.
Uh huh. No, I. So. Like I said, it was good in the movie, but I don't think, like some other scores I can listen to by themselves, but I don't think I could do that with this one. Because I think this score enhances what's on the screen, but I also think it requires what's on the screen.
I might agree with you there. Yeah, I would agree with you. And I've seen this movie several times, and I'm just going to say, I've never been bored. So, because every time I watch it, I realize something else. But also, I did that with The Prestige. I mean, both mm-hmm. of these movies I've watched several times. And I've gotten something new out of both of them mm-hmm. every time I watch.
What was it this time?
This time, for The Illusionist, are you asking?
Yes,
please.
For the Illusionist, I thought that Sophie recognized him on stage, and I think that she recognized him
when they were leaving the reception.
So,
because she does a double take right there, and I think that's the moment.
Yeah, and I think it's just because it's a visual thing,
right?
So sometimes I have to rewatch things because of that, and I think also the fact that I realize now that Eisenheim, when he got the jewels off the sword. There was another scene, to answer your question, Matt, going back to your question, what did I realize this time? Chris had a minor pet peeve. He said, why did Eisenheim look upset? Like, they didn't need to show us him being upset. But I think it perfectly fit. It's when he's waiting to find out where Sophie is. Mm-hmm. It's the night when she's supposedly murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And either way, it makes sense that he's upset. Because let's just say he was waiting for her to arrive. He would be nervous and upset. And even the other way, if he knew that she was putting herself in danger because the prince is a violent man, and that he had, which we know later, that he had staged it all. I think it makes perfect sense that he's nervous, because if you're worried about the love of your life,
right. Well, that's a problem I actually had with the Prestige and with this. The people who are manipulating other people have far too much control.
I totally agree. And that comes into what I noticed this time, because I did see it in the theaters when it came out. And I left the theater going, like, I don't like that movie and I don't know why. And I recognize now that it's because Edward Norton is not in the finale at all. He sets everything into motion and then he is not there. And everything goes exactly as planned. So there are no setbacks. We don't see him figuring all this out. It's just he has set things in motion and it ends in like, oh, wasn't he so clever? And it wasn't, you know, like a heist film isn't about the procedures of doing the heist. It's about when things go wrong, what they do. That's the conflict. There was no conflict in this. He like, I'm in love with this woman. I'm going to take down a crown prince, whatever. You know, I'll do that. Like Paul Giamatti was the only conflicted character in this whole thing. So to me, what I noticed and I finally figured out why I found it so unsatisfying is because like he wasn't there. He was a no-show for the finale and he was cleverer than everyone else at the end.
See, now my take on it is that, see, it's not a heist movie. It's to me, it's a romance and he was without her for so many years. So I love the fact that it's this like forbidden love and he can't have her because she's of a different class, but she wants to be with him. And she states it in the beginning when she's little, she says, I will go away with you. I will run away with you. And in the end, that's exactly what happened.
Right. She said, make us disappear.
Make us disappear.
And so he did.
And he does it, damn it. And that's the fact that, you know, it's my romantic heart that, you know, I don't care if it's fantasy. I really don't care. I just love it as a love story. So you can just put me in the boat of I love this movie. If you just look at it as a love story, that's why I like it.
So. See, I had an issue with that. I've been trying to figure out the inciting incident of like the whole film. And I think it's when he sees her because that's what upsets the status quo. He was, I'm happy being a magician. Like he has not thought of her for however long, no matter what he says.
See, I completely disagree. He did all of this for her. That's my opinion. That I think he totally knew she was going to be there because he had everything ready. He had the painting ready. All of these things were already ready. So he knew who she was. He knew that she was going to be at the theater that night. I think that's why the trick worked, was because I think there was someone that looked like her. There could have been many different ways that they did that trick. But like he says, wave to yourself in the mirror. I think the way I think of it is that he planned for years to do this, but he had to build himself up to get to that point. So that's the struggle that I feel is there, is that they were separated for all these years and he was pining for her for all that time. And she was also thinking of him. She says when they slept together, I looked at your picture so many times and wished for you to be there.
But that's just pillow talk, baby.
So I don't know. I guess I believe in all that kind of stuff that, you know, when somebody says, you know, like I couldn't live without you, that they really mean it.
So I know Matt's going to disagree with me, mm-hmm. but there's another level going on in this movie. And that is
the fact that all of his tricks are there in the workshop.
No, actually I didn't. I wasn't aware of that.
Every single thing he pulls off is there in the workshop.
Ah, okay. No, the level that I was thinking of is the social class, like the evolution of Europe through this time period is sort of exemplified here. And there's also, like, there's a line at the end. We knew the prince was a bad guy, but now we know he's a Nazi, so it's okay that he's going to die. And it's like the progression of the empire into what Germany became in the 40s.
This was pre-World War I, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. So this is the death of the empire and then the rise of, you know, populism and then this, then the backlash, which was exemplified here.
The country will be run by mongrels. There's a thousand different voices screaming to be heard and nothing will be done. Nothing. I've done everything I can.
That moment you almost feel sorry for him until you realize that what he means by the country will be run by mongrels is other races.
So you're saying he's ending the Second Reich and preparing for the Third?
I mean, and you've also got to realize that Eisenheim is a Jew. That puts him in a position where, you know, other lines that the prince say, I wonder if he's talking about that, such as...
But rather a wizard who has sold his soul to the devil in return for unholy powers.
I just wonder if that's like a snide insinuation on his being Jewish.
I like that interpretation. I think it could have been a significantly better movie if the prince was actually a very good man and would have kept peace for the land. And then all of a sudden you have this guy deciding, well, do I bring down the empire and take down the prince for the love of my life? You know, this is a moral quandary. This is some inner conflict. Which one do I choose? Like, but this was like, oh no, he's really a bad guy. It's okay to have him commit suicide. You can just gaslight him all you want.
Right. And I think the thing about Eisenheim is that it wouldn't have mattered if the prince were a good person.
But sure, it would have made a better movie.
I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I think he takes him down because he is a bad guy. And so that's why I think it is more clear cut. I would agree with that. I mean, you know, he's in love with this woman. The prince is a bad guy. He hatches this plan. He's been without her for a long time. And then at the end, they're together and happy. And I love it.
So I have an issue with this movie. And that is, it really is better to watch than the quality of craftsmanship that it has presented to me. Like, I enjoy watching this movie. But every time I watch this movie, I feel like it's warts and all.
Explain.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with anything that Matt has said tonight, but I still find this a very enjoyable movie to watch. Like, I don't really love the first 15 minutes or so, but if it's on and I happen to walk through the room, I'm probably going to stop and watch it.
So I think you're actually disagreeing with him because I think he thinks it's boring.
Right. I do.
Well, other than that,
boring
is an opinion. The actual, the points that he has brought up, I do not disagree with any of them.
Okay.
Fist bump.
I do. But,
well, good. So, it'd be a boring world if not for disagreements.
So I haven't heard a lot of, Pete, could you give us I've heard some of your logical choices about the movie, what you think, but what is your reaction, like your emotional reaction to this movie? Do you like watching it, Pete?
Enjoyed it. This was only the second time I've seen it, and I think the first time that I watched it, I was actually making out with someone, so I didn't really pay attention to it.
Oh.
This is the first time I've kind of sat down and watched it all the way through uninterruptedly. And I feel it's a solid romance. I like the fact that a lot of the throwaway moments actually have relevance at the end. You can literally see everything that he's everything that he sets up for the finale for the prince is all right there. It's all outside. I mean, even to the point where he looks at his he looks at his assistants and goes, "No, leave the lanterns."
Yes.
Because they come into play. They come into play when he buys the theater. You know, it's little things like that.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Thank you for saying that, and I should have mentioned that point. Yeah. That everything is. And thank you, because I agree with you.
I think that was a fun little bit, and for the most part, I'm never going to say that this is a genius film, but it certainly is a lot of fun.
I think we can rate it now.
Yeah.
All right, Matt, you're going to lead us off.
I'm going to give it a 2 gold pieces and 1 silver because it's in that bland category of just, it's there. As I said, it's the Solange to the Beyonce. There is wonder out there in the world and it just happens to be its uglier sister.
All right, Sharon, I want you to rate The Prestige.
Okay, sure.
I'm joking. The Illusionist.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces.
I'm going to give it 5. I loved it.
Five gold. She's all in.
I could make out to this movie. Wow. I could watch this movie. I could drink tea to this movie.
Wait a minute. Where were you when
Pete was watching this movie? No, I wasn't the person time. With Pete. That wasn't me. I'm married to Chris. I'm just saying. I mean, to me, it's a romance. It's in the time period that I adore. I love seeing things with period clothing, even though I'm blind. That sounds really weird. But that whole time period and carriages, and I like to know that my bad guy is a true bad guy. So, and I loved all the performances. For me, they all gave it top. Now, I didn't think anybody dialed it in. I know it. I'm disagreeing with Matt, but that's okay. And like I said, I could sit and watch this movie. There's not one boring part. And right. Everything that Pete said about when you watch it for the second time, and me, I've watched it like maybe 6 or 7 times. Every time I watch it, I get something new out of it. So
okay.
5 gold pieces.
Good answer.
Solid.
All right. All right. Pete, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate The Illusionist?
I'm going to give it... I'm going to give it 3 gold and 8 silver.
All right. Back it up.
Beep, beep. No. the problems that I had with it were I felt also that Edward Norton was very stiff. And I felt that the villain was very flat. I like my villains to have more meat to them.
Okay.
Oh, I'm supposed to ask you.
Yes.
Hey, Chris. It's no one can see what Chris was doing. He's tapping.
I'm slapping Sharon on the knee.
What does he want me to say? Does he want me to disagree?
Who can ask me?
Opinion. Oh, Chris, how many gold pieces would you give this movie?
I am going to give The Illusionist 3 gold and 3 silver. And the reasons are those that I mentioned. It's warts and all. It's an enjoyable movie. I can watch it every single time it's on. But I see that there are shorthands that are taken. I see that there are, you know, character shortcuts that were unfortunate. But I really like watching it, and I think it's very well presented. So so the 3 is the story and the way that the actors are able to sell everything to me. You know, the 4 principles. The other people. They don't matter. Nobody really matters.
3 gold and 3 silver.
3 gold and 3 silver.
Even though if you were walking through a room and it was on, you would sit down and watch it.
That's a 3 gold bar right there.
I think Matt has.
I didn't realize that he's given it a solid C there. So
yeah. Oh. Absolutely. I mean, let's talk about The Illusionist on Rotten Tomatoes has a 73% critic rating. That's a C. That's a solid C.
We need another woman on this show, because seriously.
Matt, make the change.
I'm sorry?
You gotta change into a woman now.
No.
Wow. No,
I'm inviting a female guest next time because you know.
All right. And so our final segment is going to be what kind of a role playing game would you be playing to get this story out of it?
And I
would like to present my idea first.
Are you going
to
say Baker Street?
No, I'm not. Because Sharon and I were talking about this, and she said, it's like this game. And I said, no, this is a 4-person fiasco game. Because fiasco is, it's not in opposition, but you could have characters in opposition. And there's like 4 players, there's no GM. And each character is trying to, you know, present or trying to achieve his own goals, interacting with the other characters. And the way this movie felt to me was kind of a crucible of 4 characters who had their own goals, motivations, and backgrounds. And they all had to, you know, this is what happens when you put 4 people that are these 4 characters in a crucible and light the fire under them. That to me felt like a fiasco game. So Sharon, what are your thoughts?
Well, it would have to be a game that would allow for the setting to be of that area of the world, and also the time period of being in the 1800s. So that's why I was saying, because there are things that happen in this movie that are very much
You didn't name a game.
I'm saying like Baker Street.
Oh, like Baker Street.
Something that would allow players to be in the 1800s when just at that turn of history when logic is versus spiritualism. Sorry. And to me, I think that's another reason why I love this movie, because it's like, is it logical or is it mystical? And you keep feeling that through the movie, that could it be real or does he have powers? And I love that through the whole movie.
Okay. So that's the core mystery, is it magic or is it a trick?
Yeah, and the fact that it is a mystery. Yeah. And that's why it teeters on that edge
of fantasy.
Yeah. And it's probably not, to be perfectly honest with you, because in the end you find out, oh, none of it was there was no magical powers, but that's why you don't know in the movie if it is or isn't. So that's why I think it's okay.
Okay. Matt, what do you think?
Let's see. It's been a couple of years since I've done any RPGs. So I'm going to go with like a, what are those called? Man, I'm not good at this. It feels like a LARP Vampire the Masquerade. Like, it's just a lot of dressing up and, you know, and playing around and then not really any substance to it. And there's no combat. There's not, it's just kind of there. And they're doing paper, rock, scissors every so often, but really it's just about getting dressed up.
Wow. Yeah, but Edward Norton throws little beanbags going, fireball, fireball, fireball.
No, that's Amp Guard kind of stuff. That's okay. None of them masquerade people. They just do paper, rock, scissors.
Right. Pete, what do you think?
I think an open-ended system like Fate.
Oh, yeah.
Is that something that you can fit into any time period and any given conflict?
What's our next movie, Chris?
Good answers. Our next movie is going to be a tribute to our fallen friend, Dave, who passed away at the beginning of last month, and we found out sometime later. And one of Dave's favorite things was Lord of the Rings. And I remember a lot of the conversations I had with Dave after we came out of the Fellowship of the Ring. So I thought we could do the Fellowship of the Ring as a tribute to Dave.
Oh, that would be great.
Extended cut or the regular thing?
Let's go extended cut. Go big or go home.
Nice. All right.
Also, that's the only one I own.
And it's free on Hulu. So.
Is it really? Okay.
It's the only one on Hulu. If you want the other ones, you got to get Stars.
Oh, wow. That's just mean. Thanks, guys, for joining us. And,
thanks, everybody.
And we will see you next time. And until then,
keep it real.
Thanks for staying with us to the end of the episode. If you enjoyed this show, please go to iTunes and or Stitcher and give us a good review. That'll let us know what you think and also help other people find the show. Dragon Reel would love to hear from our listeners. You can email us at dragonreelpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/dragonreel. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/dragonreel. If you want to comment directly on any episode of Dragon Reel, go over to our website, dragonreel.com, and leave us a comment. You can also give your rating of the movie yourself on our scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces. You know, the best way to enjoy the episode is to watch the movie with us, so while you're at our website, click our Amazon links to get your copy of the movie. If you go to Amazon from our site, you can buy anything on Amazon, and they will give us a few copper pieces to keep our show going. Our music is by Maggie Sansone and is used with permission. You can find this music and much more at maggiesmusic.com. Please join us again next episode.